Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to episode 115 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I am Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kessler.
Today is Saturday, February 13th, 2021. A few notable events happening in the markets this week. Off the top, Tesla disclosed a $1.5 billion investment into Bitcoin, which made the pundits go crazy, the skeptics go mad, and the price of Bitcoin surge. Has the institutionalization of Bitcoin arrived? Some very interesting news in the M&A space. The first large hostile takeover we've seen in a while, as Brookfield Infrastructure launched a $13.5 billion hostile takeover of Inter Pipeline. Will they be successful in this proposed unsolicited offer? Lastly, in SPAC news, fuel cell truck startup Hyzen Motors to go public through SPAC decarbonization plus acquisition. Is the EV market tired of EV SPACs yet? Or do they continue to love it? Mike, let's find out. But first, let's talk about Bitcoin. Electric vehicle manufacturer Tesla disclosed that it invested $1.5 billion of its cash into Bitcoin. Interestingly enough, they didn't press release this or anything. It was a footnote in their annual financial statements, 10K, I believe. Not only that, but Tesla indicated they would also begin to accept Bitcoin as payments for their products. If you're in the market for a new Tesla Model S or Model 3 and own some Bitcoin, perhaps you can pay for it with that. Cryptocurrency, if you'd like, in the future. Elon Musk, Tesla's CEO and the world's richest man, so he's got to be pretty smart, right, Mike? Nonetheless, he's perhaps the most high-profile business leader to put a stamp of approval on this asset class. And how did they do it? Well, Tesla ended the year with more than $19 billion of cash on hand. They raised $12 billion in ATM financings over the past year at the market equity offerings, where they just sell into the market, given the demand for their shares, and taking advantage of a nearly 700% surge in their share price last year. So basically, they had a lot of cash on their balance sheet and were likely concerned about the US dollar, as we've seen with other corporations and investors doing. And where else to go? Well, one place to go where an asset can serve as a store of value that can't be printed by governments is Bitcoin. Why is this development so important? Well, in my opinion, given Tesla's position as a major component of the flagship S&P 500 index, which is the most popular stock market index in the world, Tesla is in the top five. They're a large weighting in the S&P 500. And the S&P 500 is the most popular index with investors in the world. Now, Tesla's Bitcoin investment introduced this cryptocurrency to millions of investors' portfolios, because now if you own the S&P 500, you do have exposure to Bitcoin, whether you like it or not. So cool on Tesla. First, they get into the S&P 500, which is, you know, the premier index in the world. It covers U.S. equities, which are increasingly global these days, Tesla being, one global company. But now any S&P 500 investor has exposure to Bitcoin. Granted, it's small, but nonetheless, it is there, which signifies a major step for investors and a major step for this asset class. To give you a scope of the size of the implications of this, $11 trillion of investment assets are tied to the S&P 500 or benchmarked to the S&P 500. So it just gives you the scope how important this development is. But Tesla, they're the first in the S&P 500 to do it, but not the first major corporation to do it. This move follows similar investments by MicroStrategy, which we've discussed on the podcast in the past. Their CEO, Michael Saylor, he's become a Bitcoin evangelist. He's a Bitcoin maximalist, definitely bullish on the asset class. He's made a lot of money doing it, perhaps one of the greatest prop bets ever. I think Michael Saylor's made over $1 billion thus far, mark to market on his Bitcoin investments at MicroStrategy. He recently held a webinar on how corporate treasurers should move some cash into digital assets such as Bitcoin. And so far, MicroStrategy has spent about $3 billion on Bitcoin. I'm not sure when Tesla made that move, but I do know on Twitter, and Michael Saylor is very popular on Twitter, and there's no one more popular than perhaps Elon Musk on Twitter. Michael Saylor did have a tweet compelling Elon Musk to put some of Tesla's cash into Bitcoin. So not sure if they already preempted that or if they actually listened to that advice. Nonetheless, Elon Musk did put hashtag Bitcoin in his Twitter bio last month, which, from my perspective, I thought that was a good indication that Tesla may start to move into Bitcoin. And that was my prediction that I tweeted about last month, and it did come to fruition. And you look at the price action on Bitcoin, it was a major catalyst. For example, Bitcoin, it surged 24.1% this week. Obviously, a lot going on there, but certainly this Tesla news contributed to that surge. To give you a sense of other companies getting into Bitcoin, aside from Tesla and MicroStrategy, who are in for the billions, Square previously bought 50 million of Bitcoin. You had Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company buying 100 million of Bitcoin for their investment account. So this is just a trend that will keep on continuing. We'll see increasingly more corporations do this. More corporations in the S&P 500, I guarantee you we'll see more with Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Probably not to the tune of 1.5 billion. I mean, there's not a lot of companies that could do that. We've seen about two so far, MicroStrategy and Tesla. I wouldn't bet a lot, but you know, $50, $100 million checks. We'll definitely see that more and more in the Bitcoin space. Mike, what are your thoughts on what I perceive to be a major development for the asset class? Are you as bullish on it as I am?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't think this was a defensive move by Tesla, whatever they say about their concern around the US dollar or any of these companies. I think it's more of an offensive move to try to get a higher valuation multiple, which is, I mean, on from their perspective, if you can take actions to, you know, juice your multiple that the market is willing to give you, you should do that as a management team. So there's certainly nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that in a derogatory sense. That's just kind of logical.
So what are your thoughts on the, like, say, creating shareholder value? Do they do that through the Bitcoin investment going up in price? Or are you saying this improves the marketability of their story and improves their, bring more investors into the stock?
More so the latter, is that it presumably can, what we've seen historically when companies do make announcements such as these, is they kind of have an increase in their multiple. Now,
right. Sentiment.
Part of that is
so sentiment driven.
Sentiment driven. And part of that is that, yes, there's an increase in sentiment because, you know, Bitcoin, now they'll start tracking that a little bit. They'll have a little bit higher correlation with Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has gone up historically. But with a lot of volatility, but has historically, you know, performed very, very well. So it makes sense. The other thing I did want to highlight, when you mentioned some of the companies that are getting involved in Bitcoin, just today, we're recording this on Saturday, but just today it was announced, there's an article came out that Morgan Stanley, one of their investment units, Counterpoint Global, that they're looking at investing in Bitcoin. That's they manage $150 billion. So, you know, even if they're looking at a sub 1% allocation to Bitcoin, I mean, that's still pretty substantial. So I just think it's a very interesting development to watch. And I mean, there's going to be more and more of these. And I mean, are we going to cross 50K next week as the market digests some more of this? I mean, I think it's certainly a pretty high probability. The other aspect is, I guess there's kind of multiple things here, is you have the value of Bitcoin, so say as a store of value, and then Tesla, I guess, using it as a form of payment, which they're doing. And they haven't committed to that long term. It sounded like they're going to try it out short term. So who knows if they'll do that moving forward. But I mean, it really brings up the age old debate about Bitcoin of, Is it a store of value or a payment currency? And, you know, I've always leaned towards the store of value line of thinking, because I mean, I'll bring up one crazy stat that, you know, I saw last year was that 60% of Bitcoin in wallets, it hasn't moved in the past year.
Right.
And so that's if that's not an indication for the store of value argument, you know, I mean, that seems pretty strong to me as well. So then when you're looking at, you know, what is a Bitcoin worth, comparing it to other stores of value is kind of how you would go about that if you wanted to do a valuation of Bitcoin. But regardless, people ascribe value to it. So that is one thing to keep in mind. Maybe you don't agree with that as you know, just the general listener or the general investor. You may not agree with that, but other people are valuing it. So that is something to take into account.
Yeah, certainly with it trading at around 47,000 per Bitcoin with a market capitalization of nearly 900 billion, I think it's kind of tough to deny that it has value as a store of value asset. I'm less bullish as a payment mechanism because with its limited supply and obviously phenomenal investment performance, it's a deflationary asset, right? And no one wants to sell assets like that, because if they buy a Tesla with one Bitcoin and in 10 years, Bitcoin's $1 million per coin, then they're going to regret that, right? So
it's also why you're not using, say, common shares to go pay for your milk at the grocery store as well,
exactly.
Right? It's fairly solid rationale. And I mean, even on the payment side, if crypto does take a form of everyday payments, it probably just won't be Bitcoin, just because the Bitcoin payment processing network of Bitcoin just couldn't really withstand that.
Well, the Lightning network could, but it doesn't make sense because people don't want to use it. They want to spend their cash, because cash is government mandated to decrease in value by roughly 2% per year or more.
Exactly, yeah.
So definitely take that into account. I don't expect the payment thing, kind of a non-event, but buying 1.5 billion, massive event. I believe the institutionalization of Bitcoin has arrived. The signs are there. If you're not on the Bitcoin train, you know, there's only one way to go. Can't stay bearish forever. And those who have stayed bearish since 2013 have, you know, been embarrassingly wrong. Do have to disclose that Bitcoin has a 10% weight in the Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, only ETF in Canada that has exposure to Bitcoin. And now, a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest-growing alternative investment solution providers, with a suite of institutional-caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, is the world's first SPAC-focused ETF, with a diversified portfolio of SPAC and merger arbitrage opportunities in an easy-to-use, low-cost ETF. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF trades under the symbol ARB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. Let's move on to some super interesting M&A news. I always love it when we see a hostile takeover. Tough to find something more exciting than that, especially some of the M&A tactics behind Brookfield Infrastructure and their hostile takeover of Interpipeline. What happened here was that Brookfield Infrastructure built up a nearly 20% stake in Interpipeline, and they did this incognito. They're very secretive, and they structured it in a very unique way to capitalize on certain regulatory loopholes. Because in Canada, if you go above 10% ownership, you need to disclose via what's called an early warning report. So what Brookfield Infrastructure did is they bought just under the 10% level, then increased to nearly 20% via total return swaps. So they found a loophole in the regulations, they're aggressive, and they took it up to the 20% level, which is really the maximum they can take it to. And then they revealed a bear hug letter. And a bear hug letter in M&A parlance is an unsolicited offer that in a letter that you submit to the target company's board of directors, and then you make it public. It's basically like a big bear coming in and just like trapping you, and you're kind of stuck. And that's where Interpipeline find themselves now. They are officially in play due to this $13.5 billion hostile takeover from Brookfield Infrastructure. So Brookfield's exact stake is 19.65%. they approached Interpipeline's board about this potentially friendly deal last fall and rebuffed. Typically, acquirers don't go hostile initially. They'll always try to do it on a friendly basis because it's way easier, and hostile takeovers can be relatively difficult to complete, not to mention all the social issues. At the end of the day, businesses are run by people, and people tend to not look upon positively to a when their company gets taken over in a hostile situation. But nonetheless, some other interesting dynamics. Brookfield offered to increase the $16.50 per share takeover bid to a range of $17 to $18.25 per Interpipeline share if they're granted access to due diligence materials. Obviously, this deal thus far, they've only done desktop due diligence, meaning a review of any sort of public information to the filings, etc., but they don't have private information that they would get via a data room and other due diligence materials. So there is room for them to increase a price. And the reason they said that, and they came out and said that publicly, being like for shareholders to put pressure on Interpipeline's board to enter into discussions, because shareholders know that there's this carrot out in front of them of roughly 10% or nearly 10% increase in price if the board of directors engages in discussion. So they're kind of forcing them into it. Brookfield called Interpipeline stock market performance and its credit rating strained in a release. And they also stated that Interpipeline has, quote, delivered the lowest one-year and five-year total shareholder returns among its Canadian infrastructure peers. So why that analysis and statement is important is because Brookfield is saying that the current board of directors and management have not been good stewards of shareholder capital. Brookfield could do a better job, and shareholders are no doubt fed up with the poor share price performance and some of the management strategic decisions that were historically made to put them in the spot. Basically, you know, they bet the farm on a recent development project, the Heartland project, which has been mired in cost overruns, delays, and their share prices suffered. Certainly the pandemic did not help, and it put them in a compromising position, which ultimately they now find themselves in play. Thus far, Interpipeline's board of directors have rebuffed the approach. They did come out with a statement on Thursday stating that even the sweetened offer to $17 to $18.25 up from $16.50 did not reflect the true value of the company. I would like to remind listeners that in July of 2019, Interpipeline board of directors turned down a $30 per share takeover bid from CK Infrastructure, and they're not looking good now with a bid nearly half the price less than 2 years later. Mike, what are your thoughts on this really interesting hostile takeover situation, which we haven't seen in a while, especially in the Canadian oil patch?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, specific to the $30 takeover offer from CK, that was backed by Lee Ka-shing. That offer, I mean, the rationale for them turning it down was they didn't believe that they would be able to get Investment Canada approval. So right. I think that's kind of fair. It kind of puts a lot of turmoil around with the company that, you know, pretty low probability that that deal ever goes through. So, you know, I wouldn't really fault them too much for that. But, you know, looking at the background of the deal, you know, both Interpipe and Brookfield did come out and say that, you know, previous proposals by Brookfield in November, December were in the $17 to $18.25 range, but those were there were terms and or those were conditional on exclusivity for Brookfield.
Right.
So you can understand why the company, if they are making the decision to sell themselves, why not have an auction then? Really no, not necessary to give them exclusivity unless they're going to really blow their socks off with like a knockout bid. Brookfield also is not historically will not just come with a very generous bid. They're very, very, very astute acquirers.
Price sensitive and
yes,
disciplined.
Price sensitive. And that's I mean, that's as a Brookfield shareholder, that's something that you very much want in a company that does have plenty of acquisitions. As well, I mean, in that initial offer, they did have a Go shop, and we've talked on the podcast before around Go shops. Typically, private equity firms give target companies a Go shop. It's really just a way that they can pay a little bit less, because the vast majority of Go shops do not result in a competing bid. But you know, the other really interesting thing that you mentioned is the Heartland project, and I mean, really, there's kind of a few scenarios that can play out here. And I would say if you're probability weighting everything, the majority of the probability is weighted towards Inter Pipeline being sold, whether it's to Brookfield or a competing bidder.
Yep.
They're now in play. So it's a very high probability that they do get acquired, in my opinion. The only other possibility that I see, unless Brookfield just backs out for some reason, is that they announce an equity partner for their Heartland petrochemical project. As you mentioned, I mean, it is a significant bet for the company. And, you know, I think there's a lot of talk amongst investors and the company that there's definitely a delta in what the company thinks it's worth and what investors are attributing to the project. And so if the company is able to come out and announce an equity partner in the project that, you know, ascribes a pretty high valuation to the project,
right,
perhaps that's a route forward.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it seems like it's almost a certainty that, that they would be acquired by someone.
Let's get into the mechanics of that, because prior to this bid, shareholders, the market viewed Inter Pipeline as being worth $13.40, which is where it closed on Wednesday prior to this hostile bid being announced. So in order for Brookfield to be successful, they need to buy more than, you know, 50%, or, you know, if they want to take them, you know, fully over, 66 2/3, in order to complete a second step plan of arrangement and take them private. They need a mechanism to actually get their hands on these shares, i.e. they need a sufficient number of shareholders of Inter Pipeline to tender their shares at the specific price. Right now, the offer's at $16.50. They did indicate $17 to $18.25 if granted access to due diligence materials. So Mike, you're indicating if in the short term, Inter Pipeline can strike a JV that will be so accretive to shareholder value that it will increase the share price above the range that Brookfield has cited, you know, and then Brookfield walks away just because they're not willing to pay the price that the market is?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, you know, that I wouldn't say that's the highest probability, but that's the only other real possibility. And one other thing to mention is that, I mean, in the shares that Brookfield has already acquired, I mean, the 52-week range on IPL is pretty wide. And there was a lot of pretty favorable entry points. So they started accumulating their position in March of 2020. You know, depending on, I'd be very interested to hear what their average position or average price.
It went from like $20 down to $5.
Yeah. So if they were acquiring near the bottom end of that range, I mean, theoretically, even if they ascribed, you know, a $20 share price to the entire company, you know, they were able to decrease the price that they ultimately have to pay on a portion of that.
Right.
But the other thing that I did want to bring up just outside of this, I mean, that day was a pretty big day for Calgary M&A teams, as about 40 minutes after the hostile bid was announced, you had ARC Resources and Seven Generations Energy announcing that they were combining in a share deal. And so, I mean, with that deal, I mean, it's just a strategic deal, kind of makes sense. Both are well-operated E&P players, have obvious benefits to scale, but you know, nice to see as Calgary residents the activity in the space in Calgary for sure.
Local investment bankers very busy for the first time in a long time. Nonetheless, Inter Pipeline, in my opinion, will Brookfield Infrastructure be successful? I think so. I think this is high probability. If I was a betting man, which I am, I think that they're going to win in an auction process. So number one, we do know that Inter Pipeline is now in play. And Canadian regulations differ from US with respect to a poison pill. What I think will happen, Interpipeline will adopt a poison pill if they don't already have one. And poison pill prevents Brookfield from buying any more shares in the open market or via their hostile takeover offer. But in Canada, I should talk about poison pills in the U.S. And this is a just say no defense. If a board of directors wants to just say no, they put into place a poison pill. And what that poison pill does is set a certain threshold of what an investor can buy of their shares, say 10%. In this case, it'll be 20%. And if an investor goes over that threshold, then the company will issue very cheap stock to all other investors to dilute the investor that went over that threshold. So that's how a poison pill works. And in the US, they can stick around indefinitely. However, in Canada, if a target company adopts a poison pill, the acquirer will apply to get it cease traded, i.e. basically canceled by the court. And the court will do that after 105 days. So they allow the company to basically shop themselves, run a process over 105 days. And then after that, Brookfield Infrastructure can run the tender and take up shares if shareholders are tendering. Where the stock is at right now, 1743, obviously significantly higher than the 1650. So the market's pricing in a bump in price to that 17 to 1825 per share. You know, clearly they're going to bump here. I assume they're going to strike a friendly deal. Interpipeline will implement a poison pill, run an auction process, see if they can find any other buyers. I think that'll be unsuccessful because they want some competitive dynamics. However, the appetite for other companies to want to go against Brookfield, who, number one, has a tremendous amount of financial firepower, and number two, already owns 20% of the company, you're not going to find a lot of appetite for those type of competitive dynamics because any competing bidder would be at a massive disadvantage just based on size and toehold cost base, basically. So I think they'll get
and
it
IPL's,
done.
Their debt position as well is a little bit of an issue for other strategic acquirers is whether they want to increase their own leverage by taking on IPL at its current leverage levels could be a little bit of an issue.
Yeah, exactly. And so they need to be a very large company. And then it helps if they're Canadian because then it introduces Investment Canada risk and things of that nature that further put them at a disadvantage. So those are my thoughts on where things are going to head here. Market, I guess the market agrees. Interpipeline shares rallied 31.7% this week on news of the bid, market pricing in a better offer than 1650. Do have to disclose that we are short in the Accelerate Enhanced Canadian Benchmark Alternative Fund, symbol ATSX. And this is not a bet on the M&A situation. This is a legacy short position in a quantitative strategy. It was a phenomenal short for a long time. Obviously, this week, a poor short. Interesting situation nonetheless. We will monitor it closely. No position from a M&A perspective in our arbitrage fund, though. And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers. With a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance, the Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, symbol 1C, ONEC on the TSX, is Canada's first alternatives portfolio solution, providing exposure to 6 alternative asset classes, 10 alternative strategies, in one easy-to-use, one-choice ETF that charges a management fee of just 0.2%. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF trades under the symbol 1C, ONEC on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. Let's get on to some SPAC news to wrap things up here. Blank Check Company Decarbonization Plus Acquisition. I'm finding these days they have more and more unique names and good from a marketing perspective. I guess they did announce a business combination with Hyzon Motors, which is a supplier of, you guessed it, zero emissions hydrogen fuel cell powered commercial vehicles. So another sort of sustainable technology, zero emission EV deal. This was valued at $2.1 billion. Interesting to note is the structure was a bit different. So Hyzon was spun out of their parent company, Singapore-based Horizon Fuel Cell Technologies, which has been developing fuel cell tech for commercial applications for almost 2 decades, which is really interesting dynamic that I think we'll see more and more in SPAC land, because we now have over 400 SPACs out in the market, over 400 blank check companies, and over 350 are now competing for a deal, and there's only so many private companies out there. So I think we will see more corporate carve-outs where a SPAC will take on a specific segment of an existing large corporation. Now, Hyzon is relatively developed. They have more than 400 commercial vehicles on the road using its fuel cell technology. They expect to deliver about 5,000 fuel cell powered trucks and buses by 2023 and targeting annual capacity of around 40,000 fuel cell electric vehicles by 2025. So still early stage, but I believe beyond the rendering stage, which is more than some other competitors out there. This deal includes a $400 million PIPE financing, including BlackRock, Fidelity, Riverstone, and Wellington. You guessed it, the market did like this deal. Not tired of EV SPACs yet. The shares were up 13.4% since rumors of the deal broke. And so this deal was rumored a few weeks ago. They did strike a definitive agreement this week. Now trades at a 56% premium to its IPO price. It's expected to close in the second quarter, after which it will trade under the symbol HYZN. So, Mike, all is well in SPAC land as investors continue to be enamored with zero emission vehicle deals, right?
Yeah, for sure. And you have the usual suspects in the pipe.
Yeah,
where you have Fidelity and Wellington, they're involved. I mean, they're pretty much involved in almost every
deal.
Electric vehicle pipe financing. So,
yep.
Some commonalities within there. But I wanted to go into a little bit of a little trip down memory lane here with regards to the clean tech space in general, because all of these electric vehicle SPAC combinations, it's really just reminding me of a report I remember reading last year on VC investments in clean tech, where you had a lot of VC capital in the 2000s and the aughts, where it was just flowing into clean tech. And as the vintage of these funds matured, the returns were really quite poor. For many of these funds of that vintage, they were negative. I remember the CalPERS CIO describing clean tech as a noble way to lose money.
But I wonder if they would say the same about ESG now, given they've invested billions of dollars into that.
Well, that's really what clean tech. I mean, now people talk, when they talk about clean tech, they now just refer to ESG,
sustainability, decarbonization.
Sustainability,
it's a lot of buzzwords.
A different name, but the SPAC market for EVs has really just brought a massive revival to the sector for those VCs, and at least at the early stage, for those early stage funds, I would imagine their returns will be quite strong as some of those fund vintages start maturing. It still remains to be seen how the late stage and growth investors do. So some of the investors that are investing into these pipe financing and things of that nature, it still remains to be seen how they'll do on a full cycle. But so far those results are quite promising. One thing to note is that for the most part, a lot of these SPAC transactions, it's not actually technically an exit for these early stage VCs, as I think, well, in this deal in particular, 100% of the equity is being rolled over. And I think in pretty much all of the electric vehicle SPACs that I've looked at, you're seeing that equity be rolled over. So not a firm exit yet, but very promising results so far on a valuation basis.
Yeah, and one thing to keep in mind with that dynamic is there are some kind of tricks they can pull that I have seen. Perhaps they take on some debt, pay out a dividend, and then roll their equity. So they did, and then pay off the debt. Yeah, and then pay off the debt with the pipe financing. So there are ways to kind of do that in secret. But nonetheless, I mean, this is an interesting deal. Obviously, the market still likes it. We're happy because the Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, we do own shares of Decarbonization Plus Acquisition. So got to disclose that. Lots of fun things happening in the market this week. Always happy to chat about them. We are always talking about these online, on Twitter, on LinkedIn. Mike, where can investors follow you on Twitter?
They can find me at m_Kessler.
And check mine out at Julian Klimochko. We wish you all the best in your investing and trading. And until next week, we'll chat with you soon. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.